we've got a point to prove. So we've deliberately extended that point to the extent that we're now funding loans as small as $100. That in itself is evidence that you can start moving into things like microfinancing and small, medium business support for transactional goods, not just a working capital line or a term loan. So we've gone as small as $100, $200, and we've gone as large as $900,000 to $1 million. When I think about scaling, it's about making sure your product is right and your product is ripe for global distribution. One of the early theses we had was that you needed to own the capital so you could own the credit decision and the algorithm.
You have just heard from Deep Singh, founder and group CEO at CreatiLink, where he is pioneering alternative financing for businesses in Asia and around the world by creating a future of B2B payments and purchasing that will very much look like the current consumer level experience. So let us dive right in.
Good evening. Thanks everybody for joining. Very happy here tonight to welcome Deep Singh, who is the founder and CEO of CreatiLink, based in Singapore. Good evening, Deep.
Hey, Norbert. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
It's a very interesting business that you founded. Maybe a short burst on what CreatiLink is and what it does.
We're a technology infrastructure company based out of Singapore, and the core proposition we have is to enable B2B platforms to launch an embedded finance product. We're aiming to be the technology infrastructure layer for everything related to embedded finance lending.
Your history is not necessarily in retail. You are a banker by trade, and at some point then the startup fever grabbed you. What drove you to found your own business? Why did you think embedded lending is the big thing that you should be focusing on?
It wasn't a moment of insanity to launch a business during COVID. So it's always been driven by passion and having seen some successful businesses being born both out of Australia, but also globally that I admire. So there's always been this hunger to start something in a field that I have a specialization in. And by way of introduction, I did spend quite a long time, almost 18 years in credit, particularly banking and finance and covering corporate credit. And then, of course, some time at a corporate hedge fund. Ultimately, that experience taught me that there's so much friction in the way credit is delivered. There's got to be a better way of doing it. And just to qualify, what we do today is we support businesses. And if you fundamentally think about the economic growth that small and medium businesses generate globally, it's anywhere between 60 to 75% of GDP for any particular country. So that's a huge amount of support that they give to global growth, yet they don't get the necessary support when it comes to trying to build their business in equity capital perspective or even in debt capital perspective. So my view was that we could actually use things like transactional data and start using platform data, particularly e-commerce, procurement, supply chain and payments data, to start really giving them capital that they need to accelerate and grow their business.
In terms of banking, many people have tried to address this. Traditional banks struggle mightily lending to this segment of the market. Do you think that horse has left the barn, essentially? So the banks have come too late to the game and companies like yours have taken the initiative? It feels like an organization like CreatiLink, with the data-driven nature or AI-driven nature, are so much more qualified to roll up this market than the traditional banks.
Yeah, sometimes I do feel that the bank's getting an excess beating on the topic. But ultimately, the cost of acquisition and the cost of servicing a small loan of $500, $5,000, even $50,000 is just so great that it's really hard for them to make money. But more particularly, when you think about small businesses and banks' data requirements that they need, financial statements and bank statements, picture in your own mind someone who's decided to set up an online e-commerce store selling iPhone wallets or selling iPhone cases, it's unlikely that they're going to have an accounting platform that they're recording their revenue and cost and unit economics as well as their working capital in. It's more likely going to be just the data that they produce online. So there's a lot of businesses that just don't have the data necessary, particularly financial statements, to give to a bank to get a loan. It's really hard to create financial inclusion and broaden the client set from a banking perspective when the client themselves can't produce the information you need or want. Now, our thesis is that just because they don't have that information doesn't mean they're not credit worthy. There's got to be different ways of analyzing. And fundamentally, banks focus on probability of default. If you think about
the components that lead to the calculation of probability of default, things like excess leverage, poor unit economics or small margins, things like inventory going up, receivables being pushed out, payables coming in, all of that leads to a cash crunch. But if you could start predicting from the data that you collect from an online platform, things like reducing sales, reducing margins, what inventory stock looks like, how much cash flow is coming through the business, you don't necessarily need to calculate a probability of default. And that's what our AI does. It starts using predictive AI to forecasting business performance. And I think that's a neat way of addressing that point around driving down the cost of acquisition and cost to serve. You don't need to have hundreds of people analyzing the data in terms of financial statements. And you don't need hundreds of people to service that client because all of it can be done online.
Now, even if your cost of customer acquisition is lower, there must be a threshold, a minimum below which it doesn't make sense for you. So what is your limit if you extend your services to a platform?
Now, that's a great question. I'll just qualify, right? We've got a point to prove. So we've deliberately extended that point to the extent that we're now funding loans as small as $100. That in itself is evidence that you can start moving into things like microfinancing and small, medium business support for transactional goods, not just a working capital line or a term loan. So we've gone as small as $100, $200, and we've gone as large as $900,000 to $1 million, all within the platforms we work with. You can actually deploy the technology and the algorithms to calculate and get really decent outcomes. Just to share with you some numbers, since we launched our product, we've been able to fund 7,200 merchants, and we've done close to $18 million of transactional financing, and we've not had a loss. I expect losses because we're in the business of credit. But what it suggests that over a 13-month period, the data has been strong enough to show that these businesses deserve credit.
So it's not a fully stress-tested environment, but it's also not a totally Goldilocks environment. So not having any capital losses is impressive.
Yeah, we work with quite a lot of partners. And of course, as entrepreneurs, we love to exchange notes. But when we did see a huge downturn in the form of COVID, what we saw from a credit perspective was exceptional support. What you would ordinarily expect in a downturn of that nature is a huge wave of defaults, particularly in the small, medium business space. But ultimately, the government stepped in, the banks supported, the fintechs stepped in to support as well. And what that meant was that the data itself didn't actually show what should have happened. The response from the banking market and the government sector tends to smooth out some of those shallow recessions. If we reflect back on history where we've seen deep recessions and, of course, really impacting business sentiment as well as performance, we're unlikely to see that because we've discovered tools available to reduce the severity of those downturns. My point is we're looking forward to collecting the data through the next couple of cycles because it's going to be telling to how we can change the way businesses should be analyzed, not just thinking about those really deep recessions that we've had in the past.
Got it. You position yourself as a B2B enterprise. When you look at your partners, maybe you can go through an example or two of the platforms that you're working with. Being in Singapore, I assume it's not just Singapore, but maybe the whole ASEAN bloc that is of interest, especially if you can profitably serve loans as small as 100 US, as you said.
Yeah, that's right. Let's go through a couple of use cases. We are live in Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia, Malaysia, and Indonesia today. We're looking to expand globally. The proposition, you're right, is B2B enterprise, being that technology infrastructure layer for platforms. We're white labeled, so they're launching a embedded finance lending product under their own brand. Let's talk about Australia first. There's a fundamental problem in particular markets like locum, the temporary pharmacist, doctor, nurse that needs to step in to fill emergency shifts. These shifts happen when, for example, a pharmacist is sick or is in need of a holiday. So the relevant business owners need to call in locums to operate. Now, what happens in such a scenario is that you might be a locum being placed into a pharmacy, but that pharmacy had to go through an agency to find you. And agencies charge anywhere between $200 to $300 per shift. And then, of course, the rate of the pharmacist is to be paid. So it's pretty expensive to fill holidays. It's really expensive to fill emergency shifts. On the other side, locums get called in on an ad hoc basis and aren't necessarily able to plan out being a locum on a regular basis. So it is higher paying than a full-time job, but you don't have the certainty of that cash flow. We work with a partner called Locumate. They've created an app that allows pharmacies to put up jobs or shifts. And using geolocations, it's able to ask pharmacists who have also registered on the platform to pick shifts and plan ahead. Solves the problem for the pharmacy to get people they need. Solves the problem for pharmacists. Now, unfortunately, what happens is once you've completed a shift and the pharmacy accepts that the hours you've submitted by way of invoice are correct, you still have to wait for payroll. Now, payroll happens once a month. So if you did a shift on the 2nd of September, you're waiting until the 28th of September to get paid. That's a horrible wait if you're only working one day or 2 days at a pharmacy you've not worked at before. So what happens today in the platform is we have a pay now function. The pharmacist can press that pay now button and receive their payment immediately. That's a great example of $500 or $1,000 given to a business very quickly and effectively in a developed market. To the same extent, we work with platforms in Indonesia. Let's use another one, a firm called Juragan Materials, which is a leading industrial e-commerce platform. They sell industrial goods, scaffolding, cement, tiles, predominantly to the construction industry. But we know the construction cycle tends to be quite long. Having 30-day payment terms doesn't always solve your cash flow when you're a buyer of these goods. So what we've done is we've partnered up with Juragan Materials to offer a B2B pay later solution that allows buyers to extend out their payment terms to 90, 120, up to 180 days. And we've seen that really drive the success of the business because volumes have gone up. Now they're able to buy more and service more clients.
All right, with the Australia example, you completely got me because I was in the mental BNPL bucket. And this is like a real-time payroll, earned income type of processing, right? It's a fascinating use case.
Yeah, let's go through that. Fundamentally, there's a platform and there's data within that platform. There's a supplier on one side, supplier of services or goods. And on the other, there's a buyer. You can do a receivables or invoice discounting structure, which is getting money faster. Or you can do the extension of payables, extending out payment terms to your supplier by way of a buyer having 30, 60, 90-day terms, which is what we call B2B pay later. So the use cases are pretty broad, but it just shows the power of the technology and the data to allow for a number of different use cases to be explored.
To ensure your growth, naturally, you need to pick partners and get platforms taking your white label technologies that themselves have a good growth trajectory. How does that sales or business development process look? Are you known well enough that people come to you, or is it reaching out to potential partners that you have identified? How is that working?
I think we've built a pretty solid brand in a market like Indonesia, where a number of platforms have reached out. But we've got some amazing VCs that have invested in us. But more particularly, a number of great VCs who have looked at us and are continuing to look at us and therefore have opened up their portfolio. And what I mean by that is there's no better due diligence than to introduce a client from your portfolio, an investee company. And of course, once we make an impact, it's great feedback back to the VC to say, hey, CreditLink were amazing. This is what they did. We really appreciate that opportunity. We've had a huge amount of lead generation come through the venture capital channels. But of course, we do have a go-to-market strategy. We have a head of growth. We do have a sales pipeline. And that's largely driven by qualifying platforms based on the markets they're in, so the geography, the sectors they operate in, because we want to be repeatable, scalable, and profitable in our offering. We're looking for use cases we've already done that we can expand into new markets. It's a robust sales cycle and process. You can take that early wage, earned wage example and take it to places like the US or UK in the healthcare sector.
From a VC perspective, we had this discussion around payments previously as well. There is a threshold where it actually makes sense to do your own payments rather than relying on Stripe and Square. And by the same token, there is a point where if you don't offer something like CreditLink on your platform to your buyers and seller, you're missing revenue generating opportunity. So I can see that the VCs are interested in using that as an additional revenue generating stream for their portfolio companies?
You usually have to have platform maturity, and we do try to work with companies that are Series A funded or above. The reason for that is when you're at that angel seed round, you're still exploring your technology, you're still exploring your product market fit. So for us to come in, it's tough to API into something or backbone into something that doesn't exist today, right? Which is a really robust technology stack. So what we find is that the maturity of the technology matters a lot. There becomes a point where platforms are too large to entertain us because they feel they can build it themselves. We encourage that because it's important and good for their business. But what they lose out is the contextual learning that our predictive AI can offer. Because if I'm working in, say, industrial e-commerce, with three platforms in Indonesia, three in Malaysia, one in Singapore, two in India, we get so much data and learning from that sector that we can actually start giving really great intelligence. So if you build it yourself, the only data is your own. There's still more value in actually working with a partner such as ours because it allows you to actually get intelligence you wouldn't have been able to get otherwise. You're not API'd into other platforms because they're competitors of yours.
How much of that information that you get through the market platform in terms of transaction data, getting a download of the bank statements, what is the ratio of that information that you deem general and independent of the vertical, and how much is industry specific?
We get this question a lot from VCs, and it's how can your technology be used in industrial e-commerce, in FMCG goods, in healthcare? The constants are things like how long you've been on the platform, how often you use it, the value, the volume, the number of buyers or suppliers you interact with. These are constant whether you're in a payments platform, an e-commerce platform, or even a procurement supply chain platform. So what we find is that those remain fairly constant. That could be anywhere between 50 to 60% of our algorithm is fairly stagnant. And then where it changes is the idiosyncratic changes either by country or by sector. Because if I'm doing FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods, or procurement for hotels, retail, and cafes, they need a 7-day cycle or a 14-day cycle. Whereas in industrial e-commerce, you need much longer. And then the data, like the number of shifts a locum does versus the number of sales an e-commerce seller makes, they tend to be quite specific to the platforms. So you find that the data can vary. So we spend a week in changing our algorithm before we go live with another partner. But what's happening as we're both improving our algorithm and our own internal processes is that time frame is getting shorter because we're starting to achieve economies of scale.
At some point, once you covered all verticals, the additional overhead of entering the vertical just drops away, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the exact point, that once you've done, say, e-commerce platforms, we've seen data from Amazon, Shopee, Lazada, TikTok. When a new platform comes in that's aggregating data from those platforms, we don't change the algorithm all that much. It's about 95% constant. There's some small tweaks, but you've reached that point already in the e-commerce vertical that we work in.
Now that you mentioned Amazon, Amazon had a qualified seller financing program, at least in some jurisdiction. Are they still doing that themselves? Are these mega platforms ultimately competition, or have they stepped out of that space? Do you know?
Yeah, so Amazon still does it. Those that are operating their own capital business are the names like Amazon and Shopify, PayPal, as well as Stripe. Most of them go to home jurisdiction first and stay there. Amazon and PayPal expanded to the UK. Amazon's also in Japan. But what they've done is they've tended to do much larger sellers. And again, you've got to think about that cost of acquisition and the cost to serve. So the sizes tend to be larger, like 150, 100,000 and above, all the way up to 5 to 10 million. Amazon partnered up with Goldman Sachs for their Marcus business to do Amazon seller financing. That shut down about a month ago. Amazon has retreated quite a bit and is heavily focused on scaling the North America business. Hmm. And what's interesting there is it's quite a large percentage, close to 40%, I think, of the sellers are actually from Asia. So Amazon's not very much in all of 13, 14 odd Asian markets. So that's a place for us to play.
You mentioned your investors. You had a seed round last year, an extension to it this year. So you're early in that cycle. When do you expect to Series A?
We're a little bit different to most startups, actually. We're close to profitability, and I think we'll get there by the end of this quarter or early next year. Our burn rate is pretty modest. That means we can show VCs that we've got a very convincing AI strategy. We've got product, we've got revenue, and we're on a path to profitability. It's a function of both market conditions and scaling the business to a size where the negotiation for both price and amount is in our hands. And I feel that Q1 could be optimal because our revenue is starting to accelerate going into this year. And that's also a function of holidays and Christmas, right? So if you're in e-commerce or if you're in procurement, even if you're in payments, that is where the vast majority of the transactions take place in the last quarter of the year. So we're well equipped to actually hit the numbers going into year end. We're pretty excited about what 2024 holds for us. It's likely Q1, Q2 that we'll go for a Series A to the market.
Let's talk about scaling then, because there's one book I hate. It's Split Scaling from Reid Hoffman. You're not talking about that extreme end of scaling. So you could, if you're profitable, grow organically, but it's a question of accelerating it somewhat in a way that makes sense. You're not going down the very extreme end of growth at all cost.
Yeah, look, a part of that is experience, right? You can see from the white hairs that there's a lot of age and experience that comes to the table. And my team is highly qualified as well. What that's taught us is to build a long-term sustainable business that will reach a valuation at some point. It's not something you need to do in 3 or 5 years. And I think the market has shifted as well. So ultimately, the market, which was looking for hyper growth, is now saying, no, let's go for moderate. And it's great to already be on that path because we were disciplined enough early on to do that. So yeah, I do think the market has dictated a part of that, and it allows us to position accordingly.
It also seems that there is enough dry powder in the VC's coffers that's being deployed in the early stages, more so than in the later stages. Going for Series A seems to be good in terms of the market timing at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. I think about scaling slightly differently. And I mentioned it earlier in the session, which is that repeatability, that scalability, and then profitability. And that's how we think about our business. Yeah. But ultimately, once you get that formula of an implementation and the algorithm, you should be able to really put in place a sales force that helps you actually distribute the tech stack globally. And that's probably where we want to accelerate over the next 12, 18 months. What helps us is that we're extremely fortunate that there's a huge amount of talent that's available in the market that wasn't there 2 years ago. And it's because big tech is shedding. Other fintechs and other startups are shedding. And what that means is that we're picking up amazing people to help us on our journey over the last few months. So when I think about scaling, it's about making sure your product is right and your product is ripe for global distribution. Because there's no point having huge amounts of clients on a wait list when you can't deliver the product that's not right, or the sales team or the product team to support its implementation and use, of course.
Let's talk a bit about the tech stack. Is it more involved than a two-line integration on the platform?
Where it really starts, we share our developer portal with partners. And what we're finding is getting the tech teams aligned is quick. So they can read our API docs, they can start doing testing. There's a sandbox that's available. And generally they say, yes, this will take us 1 to 3 weeks to get done. The commercial conversations are the one that usually take 2 or 3 months. So the sales cycle tends to be longer because of commercial discussions rather than the speed of implementation. We do have a really strong product and technical team, and they help our clients do implementations alongside their resources to make sure that they're seamless.
As you're working across the different markets, have you found specific local requirements where you had to adjust the implementation for whatever data privacy reasons or whatever else it might be?
Of course, we're cloud agnostic, but in some markets, cloud providers aren't available. As we're thinking about European expansion, we have to think very seriously around having GDPR policies and processes in place. We're on our way to be ISO certified, which is a necessary requirement in a number of markets. We've been approached by some banks to start talking about using our technology as well. So we've got to make sure that the data security, data privacy piece is well taken care of. Our Chief Technology Officer, Dinesh Singh, was the CTO at Experian in India. So he comes with great governance and oversight. Vikram, who was global head of SME lending product at Standard Chartered, is my co-founder. When we think about product and sales process, and then of course having those regulatory pieces covered, we spend quite a lot of time ensuring that's adequately taken care of. We address it already because we are thinking about global, and we're starting to be presented with opportunities to do that. We do have to make tweaks and changes as and when necessary to cover those aspects.
Let me go back to the investor side once more, but from a different angle. So we talked about the equity investors, but you also need to finance your loan book, your credit side. How do you finance that? What are your partners there in terms of the investors that finance the loan book that you're taking on?
One of the early theses we had was that you needed to own the capital so you could own the credit position and the algorithm. So what we did when we set up the business was we set up our own credit hedge fund as well. We're licensed by the Monetary Authority of Singapore as a funds management company. And within that, we operate the CrediLink Digital Economy Fund. That fund has raised a sizable amount of equity capital and also debt capital from providers. And we're using that money to fund the loans that are originated through our technology. Now, that fund itself is actually generating 16% net returns to investors today on US dollars. As I mentioned, the data is pointing to a strong outcome that data-driven credit can be an asset class. So over time, as we scale the credit fund, it will become evident to other capital providers like banks and funds that this is something that is worth investing into.
I assume I need to be an accredited investor in Singapore to participate. You only take institutional partners, or you take individual accredited investors?
We take accredited investors and institutional investors. Right now, we've got high net worth individuals, family offices, and institutional investors who have invested into that fund. And of course, so has the team. So we make sure that our interests are completely aligned because we take managing money very seriously.
That's cool. So that's the other leg of the business then. And both are profitable.
Yes, exactly. And I think the benefit is all the other fintechs who work with capital partners. Those partners are starting to pull away because they're concerned about the credit cycle. These fintechs aren't able to raise given where the current funding environment is. They're not able to get debt facilities either. A fintech that's not growing is not raising the next round. And I think that's the challenge for a number of fintechs that don't own their capital or the credit position. When you think about interest rates, most people think about developed markets like the US where it was zero, Japan zero, UK, Switzerland, or even negative. If you're going from 1 to 5, that's a 5X, but you've not seen that in places like India or Indonesia or Malaysia. Hmm. Right? If you're at 7 and you've gone to 10, right, it's not the same as going from 1 to 5. So the interest rate sensitivity, I think, has been a little bit less in Asia. Of course, we've seen probably a couple of 100 basis points uptick over the last 7 or 8 months, but the robustness of pricing and the sensitivity hasn't been there because borrowers aren't accustomed to zero interest rates here because it's never been the case.
You also said the credit fund is you're using the investments there on a fully discretionary basis. So I'm entrusting your professional experience as a credit expert there, and I'm not picking individual platforms or tranches that I'm personally investing in. So I'm just giving that wholesale to you to make the decisions. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And the benefit of that is, of course, the investment team. You're not taking any concentrated risk because it's diversified across geographies as well as platforms.
Yeah. The friends at Kilde doing investments for also foreign accredited investors, you essentially pick a certain deal that you invest in. So it depends on what you like as an investor. Do your own due diligence on the deals and put your money based on the data that they give you, or leave it to an investment team as you have. So it's slightly different model there, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really what investors seek out. Sometimes taking concentrated risk means good, higher concentrated returns. But of course, when things go wrong, you're bearing the full losses. Whereas our strategy, because it's diversified, it allows you to have much more exposure.
How do you see this overall space, embedded finance, invisible finance, and you're really invisible if you totally white label it and the branding is with the platform. How do you see this space evolve over the next few years?
Yeah, it's rapidly changing. I think ultimately you've gone from a stage
3-4 years ago where it was really hard to orchestrate. But now you've started to see more and more people wake up to how AI can really help accelerate growth across industries and, of course, create business efficiencies. You've started seeing more and more need of credit because the banks can't always service it. Today, it's over $2 trillion of assets under management. So there's been a huge wave that's allowed for the concept of embedded finance and lending to take place and then to shape it within a technology infrastructure offering that's white labeled. I think more and more firms will catch on that they don't need to build it themselves and they can rely on a partner to execute that strategy for them. What I believe is that this trend will continue to accelerate post the next credit cycle. Now, whether that's in 6 months or in 18 months, I'm not going to try to predict that. But ultimately, there will be growth because a lot of the banks will start pulling away and try to revert back to more traditional finance. And that just creates more of a gap, which means businesses are going to start moving online. And when they're online, that's an opportunity for us to capture them. And just to leave you with a final thought on that last question, if you think about what's happened in just the last 3 years, people who used to operate phones to arrange freight forwarding and shipping and logistics are now using online platforms. Purchases at wholesalers and at markets are now buying through procurement platforms. People who used to sell shopfront retail are now selling online. People who used to make payments through banking channels are now using online payment platforms. And that trend has been around for a long time because of the advent of technology. But the hockey stick and the catalyst was COVID. And what COVID has done for technology adoption, it's really accelerated probably 25 years worth of technology adoption into 1 to 2 years. And the great news is it's not reverting back. So more and more acceleration will continue, and we're pretty excited to be playing in this space on really changing how embedded finance can operate and help a number of different small, medium businesses globally.
If you meet your 22-year-old self again, would you tell him to launch a business earlier than you have done?
No, I wouldn't actually, because the training and development you get at large organizations, it prepares you to think slightly differently. Basic things like governance and audit, go-to-market strategies, defining a product, all of that comes with the rigor of an organization that trains you to think that way. And we as an organization would have missed out if we were all starting at the age of 22 and heading into this business, because there would have been so many gaps of what we don't know. And of course, through age, maturity, and experience, we've been able to have someone pay us while we were in a corporate life to learn those lessons. So now as we've spun out, we're really being able to capitalize on that experience because we've gone through that learning. We've made those mistakes on someone else's account.
Cool. It was a brilliant conversation. Really super interesting business and very excited to see this already expanding quite a bit regionally and then hopefully coming to Japan at some point too. And we'll have Tiffany to thank from MS&AD Ventures who made the introduction.
Indeed. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to the opportunity to meet you and some of your great listeners from Japan and around the world.
Wonderful.